stereophonic sound.
Science. Oh, baby. In action.
Sound science.
The sound.
Is a matter of science, 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 scientific knowledge.
The power of the cosmos.
Yes, 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 yes. No, no.
Una verdad se inventa con su.
From the cat who wakes you with paws on your face to astronauts swallowing blobs of jelly in space, we all eat. Something so universal. Life feeds on life. One organism becomes another organism. It's the first thing we do before we're even born. It's the last trace we leave after we're dead. But food, this simple, basic thing, is just a tiny, tiny part of a big, complicated mesh of things. We tend to focus on that thrilling moment when the fly is caught in the spider's web, but ignore the days of weaving and waiting, ignore all the other strands of silk not entangled with the prey, but still eminently, quaveringly part of the story.
And as we discussed last semester, the army ants will leave nothing but your bones. Perhaps you've encountered some of these insects in your communities, displaying both their predatory and defense characteristics while embedded within the walls of flesh and passing for what is most commonly recognized as human.
Eating is entangled with a web of other processes, other lives, and other desires. And how each of these other lives, whether pandas, wasps, fish, or parasites, are each their own subjects of their own unraveling food stories. But first, let's start with just you. Well, actually, an ecosystem that lives inside of you.
Deep inside the human body is a community of organisms that contribute so much more than we think to the process of digestion and help us eat food. This tiny, microscopic community consists of bacteria and other microbes. The human body is 90% bacterial cells. But before you freak out, just know that we would not exist without these organisms. We call the collection of microbes that inhibit the warm folds of our large intestine our gut microbiome. These small organisms aid in digestion and absorption, and without them, digesting food is a lot more difficult. Think about how digestion feels when you are on an antibiotic. Not very good, right? We need our gut microbiome almost as much as food. And fun fact, each human gut microbiome may be as unique as a fingerprint. Research has currently been delving into the microbiome. A study by Andrew Moeller found that chimpanzees that socialized more had a more diverse microbiome. The study even found that the chimpanzees had as much microbiota in common with unrelated individuals as mother and child had in common. Having a more diverse gut microbiota leads to a healthier organism overall. With a diverse microbiome, immunity increases. This may suggest that social interactions diversify the human microbiota as well and keep us healthier. A study by Mason Stothart found that stress decreases the diversity in our microbiome. Simply adding another way that stress can negatively affect your health. In the future, companies may look into developing drugs targeting the microbiome to help with illnesses such as obesity and colorectal cancer. And if all this talk about the human microbiome has you excited, be sure to check out the American Museum of Natural History's current exhibit on the human microbiome. While on the topic of microbiomes, did you know that organisms other than humans and even objects have their own microbiomes? Cheese has its own microbiome. Eliza Skornsteiner has looked into the microbiome of cheese. She's found that the rind of the cheese has a microbiome that plays a fundamental role in preserving the cheese and creating its aroma. The microbiota on the rind also play a large role in food safety and can inhibit the growth of dangerous bacteria. One interesting finding that she discovered was the presence of a marine bacteria on the rind of cheese. Hopefully more research will delve into the quirky microbiome of this wonderful fermented food.
The sounds you heard during that segment were taken from the Human Microbiome EP, created by the artist Kagan Breitenbach. As John Hartigan, a multi-species anthropologist, says, "It's a vivid reminder that we live in a reality where we are only part of the picture. Are we really in control of the many other worlds, the worlds of electricity, toxins, fungi, climate patterns, inhabiting our world? To overlook the complexity of this landscape of forces, all the non-human power circulating around and within human bodies, leads not only to a partial vision of the world's processes, but also behaviors whose consequences might affect the entire biosphere." A collection of essays written by Amy Leach, titled Things That Are. This one's called Radical Bears in the Forest Delicious. There once was a king of Babylon who was too proud, so he was given the mind of an animal and put out to pasture. For 7 years he roamed the fields on all fours and munched on grass, after which period he was allowed to return to his palace and rich robes of purple, his barley beer and skewered locusts and royal hairdresser, who gave him back his dignified ringlets. Along with an animal's mind, he had been given the animal's hairstylist. It is not specified which animal's mind Nebuchadnezzar received, but from his glad return to civilization and fine cuisine, we can infer that it was not the mind of a panda bear. If he had had a panda's mind for 7 years, in the end he would have rejected the restitution of his kingdom. He would have somersaulted away to continue leading a free, elusive, unfollowed life. Having followers is an honor pandas dream not of. There is no tragopan so trustworthy, no bush pig so dependable, that they would want it tagging along. Pandas even head away from pandas, like the stars in the universe, spreading farther and farther apart. You can never be too far away to say goodbye. Except their territory is neither infinite nor expanding, and in order to deliver more panda bears into existence, they can't just scatter into particles at the end. Pandas come together every 2 years or so. Marriage isn't always marriage of the mind. Maybe if they had been given a choice, they would have picked a less conspicuous coat, one to better correspond with their reclusive spirits. Admirers can be secret admirers, and afflictions can be secret afflictions, but pandas cannot be secret pandas, since they contrast dramatically with green ferns, gray rocks, pink rhododendrons, and their own bellies and ears and legs. They are showy bears, sensationally visible, which might actually be an advantage for a solitary species. The easier to avoid you, my dear. Camouflaged animals must always be bumping into each other. What does the animal do all day who is not engaged in society, its duties and pleasures and ferments? There may be some wedging in trees, some gazing into the mist, some fiddle-faddle. Sometimes the panda breaks an icicle off a branch and tosses it into the air over and over until it melts. Sometimes, trotting pigeon-toed across a hillside, he trips, then rolls, because he is round. Having enjoyed that, he climbs back up and rolls back down. He might pick up wild irises or crocuses and recline along the fern fronds to eat them, or lounge underneath a weeping willow, munching on the little leaflets that dangle into his mouth. Mostly what pandas do with their own time is eat bamboo. Bamboo, that sturdy wooden grass, makes up 99% of their diet, and they eat it for up to 14 hours a day. They have to consume it constantly, since they are only assimilating about 20%. Their penitential diet is a mystery. Pandas are like celery saints. Everyone else is convivially dining on stuffed eggs, truffled fingerlings, little pies and oranges, enjoying the tableside crooners, while out behind a bush sits a celery saint with his basket of celery. Crunch, crunch, crunch. Eat enough pies and you can put aside the desire for food and pursue something else, such as a cowhand. Rare is the romance of the celery extremist. With their carnivorous anatomy and their herbivorous behavior, it is as if pandas are pledged to an ancient covenant, as if they used to be bon vivants like other bears, blood and berry juice staining their muzzles, slugabeds all winter until one day they fell into a trance and received a deep message. You are standing, pandas, on the very borders of the eternal world, but you have become charmed with infatuating food. The subtle poison of sensuality courses through your veins. You must disregard custom and the strong clamoring of appetite and passion. It will take, at times, every particle of willpower which you possess, but give yourselves wholly to a bamboo diet, and guided by firm, unspotted principle, your lives will become pure and noble. Thus was formed that radical sect of bears, the bamboists. Modern-day bamboists show a remarkable resistance to temptation. A stream runs by, serving up fresh fish, and what does the panda do? Wades across to get a stiff thicket of bamboo on the other side. But willpower might not entirely account for such abstemiousness anymore. Bamboo is not power food, and the bear who eats it is not a power bear, and swiping fish from the river takes energy, as does sleeping all winter. If you're going to sleep for 7 months, you need to eat your hickory nuts, your ungulates, your honey. Bamboists have to stay awake all winter to eat bamboo. Incidentally witnessing the sapphirine sparkles of snow falling from a branch, the cliffs draped with icy fringes, the white snow powdering the green bamboo leaves. Could any dream compare with winter? What does a panda know who studies just a few cloudy mountain miles of the world? From her experience, she must know about fallibility. Icicles melt, flowers fail, intangibly small babies grow tangible and autonomous. And one day, when you have come back from foraging to collect yours from the tree fork where you left him, he is gone. Mushrooms, moonlight, everything is ephemeral with one exception. Bamboo. Bamboo never fails. Bamboo is eternal, evergreen, green in the orange season, green in the white season, green in the green season, poking up sweet little shoots into the spring rain. Blessed is the bear that trusteth in bamboo. For lucky pandas, it is true, bamboo never fails. Bamboo can be eternal for 100 years, which is 4 times as eternal as panda bears. But there is in the character of bamboo a devastating defect. Most grasses stagger their dying, piece by piece, like an orchestra. Though a trombonist goes down, the collective life carries on. The trouble with bamboo is that it crashes all at once. After a century of continuous availability, the entire thicket flowers together, dies together, and like a dead orchestra, it can take 20 years to get back on its feet. At this point, an animal might wise up and become a whateverist. With so many edibles in the world, why consume, almost exclusively, a miserably nutritious, erratically fallible one? It's not as if bamboo is pleasant to eat, like horse beans. Bamboo splinters poke and scratch the swallower all the way down. That old covenant was arbitrary and perverse. Bamboo is a silly staple. Specialism is folly. Consider pragmatists. When the linguine runs out, the pragmatist will eat the centerpiece, and when that is done, he will eat the tablecloth. As pragmatists have no principles, their numbers are myriad. But pandas betrayed by bamboo go looking for bamboo. There is such a thing as specialized hunger, being hungry for one thing, similar to specialized loneliness. Sometimes they don't have to travel far. Pandas eat several kinds of bamboo, and even though arrow bamboo collapses, there might be umbrella bamboo growing nearby. Sometimes they have to go further afield, and sometimes they travel in pitiful directions. Would you know which way to go to find a hotbed of celery? Until their coats don't fit very well anymore. Vagrancy used to be easier on the animals, because there used to be more forest. Even if an expedition wasn't efficient, it was forestry all the way, just as the journey from earth to heaven is milky all the way. Now, between patches of forest there are villages and gravel mines, steep cornfields, dance tents, frightened people waving blankets, mushroomers, other things to avoid. People have tried to help pandas become pragmatists, to see sense, to switch to alternatives during bamboo strangulation. And in captivity, they comply. They eat the yams and bananas and fish set before them. But compliance is not conversion. When they are set free, pandas return to their ruinous fidelity to bamboo, shuffling past opportunity. For on the far side of that hill might be the forest delicious, where they can lie back in the million-column sanctuary, a bamboo cane in each forefoot, crunching on the one and then the other, munching on flappy bundles of leaves. There are fewer than 2,500 free pandas left, and they're all in the same boat made of bamboo. When it goes down, they go down with it into dark water, and they won't switch to another boat, not for all the tea in China. Pandas have their own wisdom, unaccountable and unamendable, whose roots shoot down deeper than we can penetrate. And if they mind anyone at all, it is someone far more elusive than man.
Old Man River, Old Man River, he must know something, he don't say nothing, he just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling along. He don't plant taters, he don't plant cotton, and them that plants it are soon
going to roll along and speak with Professor Ravare Richter about her work with the unexpected homologies between human and non-human food systems.
Okay, well, I'm Monica Ravare Richter. I'm a biology professor, and my area of study is food choice. There's this really cool old story that I tell my students in the animal behavior class when we look at cultural transmission of behavior in non-human animals. And there was a group of Japanese red-faced macaques on the island of Koshima. And a behavioral biologist and his students went over to study those. And when they were not there, they had one of the residents of the island, I think her name was Mrs. Mito, feed the animals, provision them so that they would stay nearby and become accustomed to humans. And doing that, of course, is controversial these days, but that was the custom back then. And she would provision them with sweet potatoes and with wheat. And one of the young macaques would take the sweet potatoes, which were placed on the ground, to the water and wash them and eat them. And that would be beneficial because the sandy ones really wear down the teeth. And that same individual also would take the wheat off the sand and throw it in the water. And the sand would sink, but the wheat would float and scoop it off. So it was this behavior, an insight into how to feed. This was not done by any of the other macaques, but it spread throughout the group. First, other young juvenile monkeys would copy that behavior, and then they started passing it on to their siblings, and within 3 months, several of the juveniles and the mother of the one macaque who did that, her name was Emo. So Emo's mother and some of Emo's colleagues, young juveniles, would do that behavior. Then it started passing on to their older siblings, and those other families, the mothers would acquire it. Interestingly, adult males never copied the behavior. But it spread through the group that way, and then eventually, you know, over time, pretty much everyone had it. And so we had a similar situation with that here, where we did work with zebra finches and their copying of behavior. And if you put out, say, red seed and green seed and see what the initial preference is for males and females, and we had males and females that were pairs in adjoining cages, so I could put something in between so they couldn't see each other, but they could still do all their back-and-forth song and keep up their pair bond. And so we got baseline preference for red and green, and then for the males, we would have, let's say, red be distasteful. I put a little bit of quinine in it, so they'd stop eating the red. And while they were eating, we let the females watch them and did that for 5 days. And at the end of 5 days, we gave females the red and green, and the males were avoiding the red, and the females copied the male behavior. Just like the monkeys, however, the adult males would not copy the females. They had to learn it the hard way. But and also when the females were having the choice, there was no quinine there. So that kind of copying of behavior is not uncommon. And in the macaques, it was passed down culturally, you know, through tradition from generation to generation. And I didn't know this whole story, but when I was a little girl, I used to go to the Milwaukee Zoo and watch the Japanese macaques there. And they washed their potatoes. It turns out they're descendants of this group on Koshima, I found out years later when I took animal behavior. But so, yeah, non-humans do have these cultural transmissions of behavior. And in social insects, what can happen, or other non-learned, would be, let's say there's a presence of another individual by food, or there might be an action of another individual by food. The presence is referred to as social facilitation of foraging, and then the actual needing the actual action would be local enhancement. Finally, I'm at the social insects. If you put out feeders, and on some feeders you'd put a model, what we'd do is chemically extract the odors from social insects, then pose them in lifelike foraging poses. Ray Chaguerre down in chemistry taught us how to do the extractions, came up with a technique that worked for us, and then we would pose them and put them on artificial flower arrays, basically, that we had sucrose or honey solutions in. We found that certain species tended to have this local enhancement. They would tend to go to occupied feeders, and on those occupied feeders, they would tend to go to the occupied flowers. Okay? Others did exactly the opposite. They would tend to avoid the occupied feeders, and if they did go to an occupied feeder, they'd go to an unoccupied flower. Which do you think were the big ones, and which do you think were the little ones?
Big ones on the occupied.
Yeah, bingo. Okay, and it would be sort of like, it's possible that this, the presence of others could serve as an indication of food quality. Think if you were going down the highway and you got off and you needed some lunch and you're going down the street in a strange town and you see various places where you might get food. Let's say one parking lot is really full and you know, you see a lot of activity going in and out of the place. You figure that might be pretty good food. Another place is real empty. But you might be in a rush, so maybe you go somewhere in the middle, or I'd love to go to that place that's really full, but I can't, you know, go through the line there. But maybe you're driving up on your Harley in your leather jacket and you cut to the head of the line, or you're in the presidential entourage. So you can use the cue, and then depending upon who you are, you can act accordingly. So that's kind of, you know, in an analogy form, how we've seen this play out in social insects.
Let us sing a song to thee.
Okay, I could talk about honeybees a little bit. Both the past experience of honeybees and information they get from other individuals will influence their food choice as well. And individual foragers will learn to associate certain color patterns, odors, or colors and patterns and odors and shapes with profitability. And then when they go back to the colony, the dance message they give is a function of what they've experienced. And then the other bees use that information, the dance gives them information about the odor of the resource, when the dancer actually will regurgitate some of the resource. They can get direct information about the profitability, the length of the dance, and certain characteristics of the dance also indicate profitability. And the dance will indicate something about the distance, and if it's a great distance, something about the direction of the food, so that they can actually be recruited to go to that food source. I mean, the, you know, the bees who are in the colony can evaluate it, and usually the dancers that dance more vigorously and longer and give other signs of profitability of the resource are those that are better able to recruit. But it's always changing, because if all the bees go to one place, the resource might be depleted, and then that dance, they, when they come back, they stop dancing so much to that one, and others are dancing more vigorously, so they'll be the ones that are followed. So that's another way of giving information about food to others.
So it's like dancing a map, in a way.
Basically, yeah. Yeah, they call it the dance language, because it really conveys that symbolically what where the food is.
Oh, my sweet honeybee.
It amazes me every time I see this. And I've actually, back when I was a student, I was doing an ethogram. It's a behavioral catalog of a species, and I chose honeybees. And I watched a dancer in the colony, and, you know, this is an observation colony with glass over it, so I just watched the dancer. But I took the information from her dance, got my compass, walked the distance, and this... It's awful. It got me behind some really seedy bars next to a railroad track. It was like this desolate area and not in the best place, but that's where the bee said to go. And there was this little patch. I forget if it was dandelions or goldenrod, but there's this little patch of flower. And there is a bee on it.
I went to walking, and what did I see? Oh, my sweet honeybee.
And I took out my pen and put a little bit of paint on a pin at the end, or my pencil actually, and dabbed the bee with a dot of color that was permanent mark, and went back to the colony. And it was that bee. And I'm like, oh my God, this is real. But I had to do that to make sure. So, yeah, it definitely conveys information, because I was way the hay out there in the middle of nowhere following the bee, which had previously been unmarked. And so, well, okay, let's see if I believe this or not.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was really something.
Wow, that's so amazing.
Oh, my sweet honeybee.
So bees have their own language, waggling about the places they've been, stitching geographies into a net of flyways.
So they call it the dance language, because it really conveys that.
In Sean Borrowdale's book, Bee Journal, he writes, "The bees are rigging the houses, crack, lump, recess, ridge, to the commune of memory. You are a brain in impermanence, coding, knowing, keeping. The latitude and longitude of this, our house, each bee a synapse, slowly forming an arrival. I had to say, today, I said, you have locked us inside your noise truss." And we also have our own language of bees, as we describe our bodily entanglements through sensation and taste. In Catriona Sandiland's essay Pro/Polis, she describes Borrowdale's bee experience. He tastes the places and paths that the bees dance about, seasonal sugar nut. Borrowdale writes, "I taste its juice. Sweet gods of the evergreen, woods' taste, crushed music, bars and epiphanies of dripping air." Borrowdale begins to consider the world from something like an apiocentric perspective. What do the bees need? How do they know? What am I to them? How can I imagine their lives through the translational medium of honey? And then, finally, he asked the question that Monica has been able to respond to with her research. What if we could share a language? Borrowdale writes, think what paths would be if we could envisage flights tracked to their nectaries, pinpoint coordinates. Our round dance tells tales in midair's mile or so round trip. We bring, bee friend, yellow pollen on our legs.
My own species is a bit more of a cipher to me. With the humans, I mean, I've always been really interested in the ecology and the behavior of non-human animals and how they choose food and what the impacts of that food choice are on ecosystems. But at some point I was asked to come over to neuroscience and give a talk in their intermediate level course about what I did. And I was talking about optimal foraging in honeybees, you know, the idea that they tend to choose the most profitable, the resource that maximizes either their energy intake per unit time or their profitability per run foraging. And somebody said, does that apply to humans? And I, you know, like, that would be real unhealthy. And then I went, holy moly, it does. And, you know, these are some of the issues we have. Because our environment has changed so radically, and our predispositions for food choice are often not appropriate for the food environments in which we find ourselves. That came a course I teach called The Ecology of Food, and also a book I'm writing where I'm trying to look at some of these first principles of food choice, like choosing fruits, which is something Eleanor is going to be studying soon, or choosing flowers to visit. And a fruit and a flower are advertisements. You've got visual cues, olfactory cues, you know, etc. And it's the same when I walk down, not quite the same, but I walk down the vegetable aisle in the grocery, or better yet, at the farmer's market. So an understanding of how, in general, organisms respond to these cues and make their food choices, combined with an understanding of what are the ecological impacts of those food choices, I think is really important. And so what I'm trying to do is learn from what I know about more general approaches to foraging behavior and see what we can learn from that helps us better understand our own food choice and the consequences of that food choice. So that's kind of what I'm in the thick of right now. One of the things I found was fascinating, this is a little bit off to the side, I've looked at plant defenses a lot. Plants don't want to. If there's strong selection against them getting eaten to the point where they can't grow and reproduce, and so they may have certain chemicals which are repellent, say, to an insect, or even toxic to an insect or an herbivore. We actually use some of those compounds in our cooking. If you look at cuisines from countries that are very warm, they tend to have much more of the spices which will kill bacteria than do the cuisines of other countries. This is some work at Cornell, which is where I studied. They have a really wonderful library for the hotel school that has all these traditional cookbooks going way back when. And so Paul Sherman and some of his students did work drawing from those cookbooks, comparing the cuisines, and also testing to see the bacterial inhibition that these chemicals would have, or, you know, these plant extracts would have, otherwise known as spices, and found really strong correlations. And also meat tended to have more of it than vegetables, because you think, how does an animal defend itself from threats in terms of, say, bacteria? What responds if you get bacteria?
Our immune system.
Right, and if you're a piece of meat instead of a whole organism, that doesn't work anymore. However, plants, they can be greens on a plate or, you know, cinnamon extract, and that still works. So, as predicted, there's more put in the meats than in the vegetables. So insights like that are fun. I'm still working on learning about human use of cues in, say, advertising and things like that. I've been reading a lot in that, and that's one of the things I have to pull together. I have the animal portion of that chapter written. So much about marketing. Yeah, just, you know, watching people at the farmer's market, watching chefs at the farmer's market. I've made parallels between how they choose food and how these other organisms choose food. But I find some fascinating parallels.
No one is the savior they would like to be. The song of the buzzard in the dogwood tree.
Basically, the other thing, and I told you, I warned you I'd talk about fish because I just find this so compelling. And in my family, when I was a kid, my older brothers, we lived on Lake Michigan, and my older brothers were told, go bring home some fish for dinner. When I was a kid, fish were a really important part of my diet. And even before I was born, my grandfather, during the Depression, he had a heart condition, and he didn't have a job, and he had a family to feed. My grandfather used to feed his family in part by going down to Lake Michigan and fishing off the piers there. And then he had come home through, this was in the city, but there was a park there, and he knew his mushrooms really well. So he would forage for mushrooms. And when I was young, my brothers would be sent down to the lake to go get fish for dinner, literally. And so this was a really important supplement to my diet. What I didn't know is by the time I came along, the fish we tended to eat, my family wouldn't eat those icky bottom feeders. They wanted the big predators. Were full of PCBs and mercury. Still not knowing this, I nursed my daughter. And, so this legacy is passed down like that. That ecosystem becomes part of you. But the other side is, you know, when you think of commercial fishing, though we do not necessarily go in the ocean or in the Great Lakes for commercial fishing ourselves, we absolutely are as much a part of that ecosystem as if we were in there swimming with the fish. And that connection is just so profound to me, I guess in part because of my own fish story. So, and similarly with agriculture and things like that, that's a more altered ecosystem in terms of how the habitat is altered. Same kind of thing. You don't necessarily think of this this really intimate connection you have with an ecosystem when you eat the food that comes from it. But to me, that's really compelling, and I'd like to make it more compelling to other people because maybe we'd be making more sensible choices, both for our own health and also for the impacts that it has in the systems from which we eat. Direct marketing, and that's how I choose to get most of my food, and, you know, as much as I can from local farmers. I'm lost in the grocery store, and in fact, in trying to do some of this research, I'd go into places like Walmart to see if they had organic food and how they were selling it, and inevitably, I'm in the store for, you know, like 2 minutes, and my are saying, do you have your notebook or something, Mom? I say, no. But someone will come up to me and say, can I help you? Or even, is there a problem? And I don't know how to begin to answer that question. Is there a problem as I survey the foodscape at Walmart? But what I do is I have a couple friends who sell at the farmer's market. These are farmers I bought from, and they have become my friends. And I love doing math on the fly. To get money for school, because I became self-supporting when I was 16, 17. I had to get a job, and I was a very small stature. The local Howard Johnson's, which was the high-end restaurant, wouldn't hire me. They said, ha ha, you look like you're 10. But I could do math. McDonald's hired me. And I did center register, and I did the math in my head. Instead, we couldn't push the Big Mac mutton back then. And I was vegetarian at the time. What I would eat was I'd take a hamburger bun, put it inside out, and put two slices of cheese on it and grill it in the Big Mac press. But anyway, so I worked the center window there and got my money for college. After that, I worked at various restaurants. And again, what I really loved was just pairing up people with good food. Thankfully, I worked at better restaurants than at McDonald's, but, you know, that's what I had, and I had to do something. And so that connection between pairing people with the food is something I really love. I've worked on some local farms in the growing, and you would think as an ecologist that would be my niche, but it actually got very funny. I was working on one farm where they had seeded plugs of lettuce, and then there would be like three lettuces coming up, and you're supposed to take out two and put one in the field and let it grow out. And I would be three quarters of a row behind all the farmers. And Giovanni would come back and look at me and see me contemplating these, and he'd say, "Monica, this is what you have when you get what happens when you have too much education." You know, because I'm trying to figure out which one has the best prospects. How does it match the ones nearby? And he says, "Just leave the one in the middle," plunks it in. I'm too overly analytical when I'm out in the field, which I guess is not surprising. But when I'm on the front line at the farmer's market doing math in my head, listening to what people are interested in, telling them about the food and pairing them up with the food, that's where I really thrive. So that's where I see that. And I see different people coming to the market than used to come. For example, there are, WIC women with infants and children, and various kinds of vouchers people can use to get food, and a lot of the farmers will actually add a little value to that when people come with the vouchers. So, I think that direct connection is the way to go, and there are various ways to cultivate it. I realize I'm a bit of an outlier here in terms of what I value, but then again, I've seen when I lived in Madison, Wisconsin, they had a farmer's market that got huge, and it really changed the countryside because it was made opportunities for all these farmers to come in and sell directly. And so I've seen this kind of thing happen from the bottom up. Now, to affect political change, you really do have to work at the other end, as my colleagues here continue to remind me. I'm very much more comfortable with that one-on-one bottom-up work with the farmer thing, but we need to change the system too, and that has to come from the other direction.
Yeah. How do you feel about GMOs?
That's really interesting. There's a book that I use in ecology class, and it's written by Raoul Adamczak and Pamela, I'm going to forget her last name. But the thesis of the book, Pamela is a molecular geneticist. She works on rice. And specifically, one of the studies she was reporting on was she was working with some students from Asia to try to get into some varieties of rice, genetic material from another variety of rice, that would allow the rice to be flooded for 2 weeks and not die. And that would kill the weeds, and then you could take the water off the paddy and you don't have to use herbicide, and the rice would be fine. But some of the most productive varieties of rice didn't have that genetic material. And so what their group did was to use molecular methods to locate the genes, used conventional methods to make the transfer so that people wouldn't get upset that this is a GMO, and were able to do this successfully. But it's much quicker if you use the molecular methods. I personally have no problem with that. This isn't a big corporation, and it's something that's not, people aren't going to be making money selling pesticides. It's unlikely to, you know, you have to worry about allergens. I'm a very allergic person, but it, you know, manipulations of that sort, or being tolerant to drought or something like that, I could see some utility for. But the way GMO is used by large corporations, and the integration of, it's not just the plant, it's the system. You know, you get the Roundup Ready and you get the Roundup, etc. Or if there's something that's got a characteristic in it so that pests don't eat it, well, there, you know, that's adding a component to the food that allergic people like me might have an issue with. But it's also saving a lot of farmers from being sprayed with or contacting pesticides. So maybe I would accept that on my cotton, but not on my food. But the whole corporate aspect of it I find extremely alarming. And so anyway, Tomorrow's Table is the name of the book, and I would highly recommend it. I've gave Gordon Sachs and his farm a copy of it, and they have some people there who are very vehemently anti-GMO, and so I, you know, probably seem like the great Satan or something, but I really think we have to objectively evaluate both sides, and I absolutely respect the decision to avoid it, but as a scientist, to me, the evidence that there are ways in which it potentially could be used in ecologically appropriate ways and ways that didn't threaten human health, but I would be pretty darn careful about it. Another contrary approach to that, though I would love to see her recent thoughts on it, is Barbara Kingsolver has written an essay called A Fist in the Eye of God. She has a very sophisticated understanding of biology. She was trained as a biologist. She's also an excellent writer and has strong analytical skills. And, you know, to her, this, when she wrote this essay, she thought the whole approach was just anathema, and she gave a very beautifully reasoned argument. So I usually pair her well-informed, scientifically informed argument with this other scientifically well-informed argument. I have to tell you about the rest of the book. The co-author, the husband of Pamela, is the head of the organic gardening program at UC Davis. They both work at UC Davis, so you have this coexisting in the same house. And I was once speaking at a meeting for an environmental studies organization. I'm going to forget the whole name, but there's a panel on food, and I was asked to come and talk about the course I teach here. And there was a big contingent from Davis, and this book had just come out. And I asked them, what did you think of this book? And the expressions flowing over this fellow's face were just alarming to me. And he was just like, he got really red and tensed up, and then he got sort of blotchy and white, like he was going to cry. And then he got, I thought he was going to get punched in the face. And he was... It turned out he's vehemently GMO, but he had worked with Raoul Adamczak in the gardens and thought that this was one of the best organic farmers there was, and was just completely torn apart by this book. So we sort of ended the conversation there. But yeah, people feel passionately about this. And come on, he's a social scientist. And, you know, I'm the other kind of scientist. And so... We still have a lot to discuss. I don't have pronouncements or answers there. Just I appreciate what I learned from my students about their points of view on the issues. And I continue to talk about it with local farmers here, too, if they want to. But, the processes we're using to manipulate organisms, some argue that we have done selective breeding for many years. Domestication in humans, and it really is a two-way relationship, because the plant is gratifying our needs, and we in turn are changing the earth to support this plant. And Michael Pollan has written beautifully about that. This is part of a continuum then. You know, we argue domestic breeding, and this is just another using a different technique to affect that kind of selective change on organisms. But some people feel that crosses a line, and others don't. And, you know, certainly I would say there are applications of genetic modifications to agriculture, which I think are very wrong-headed. Using BT, for example, and engineering it into the plant, if it's always there, then that takes a tool away from the organic farmer, because the pests, if they're constantly exposed to it, will develop resistance. And applying BT as needed and then not having it out there is a very important and non-toxic tool organic farmers can use. And I think it's really wrong to take away that tool from them. Right? It's just an injustice. Yeah. So, and yet, if you use that, say for cotton production, the exposure of people working in the fields to pesticide is greatly decreased. So, you know, we have to figure out ways around this.
How do you think the system could be changed to make it more beneficial for farmers, or also just for healthy eating throughout the United States?
That's a question.
Considering how cheap, you know, like uh-huh. a Big Mac is.
Yeah, no. Somehow we have to come to value good food, because if we don't value it, we won't have it. And the best way you can support farmers is to value their food and to buy it and to give them a fair price for it. But how to propagate that is something that, again, I've seen this work from the bottom up, and it's part of the reason I really enjoy teaching. My students are my inspiration when I see what they go out and do and what they bring in here to share. So, you know, my own personal role, if I can help them have the science sound, I know that they're going to do the rest beautifully. So that's sort of where I fit in. I'm not packed. We all have different things that we can do effectively, but at very least, if I can help people who have those skills that I lack have sound science, then we're collectively going to get somewhere.
Between us there is only air.
Sort of intimacy of eating food, it actually becomes you. But the other side of this is that you actually become part of the ecosystem.
The air we
The song you heard during the Honeybee segment was created by the Skidmore band Swan Dive Sales. The name of the song is Bees.